Here's a name you know from the movie Good Morning Vietnam. His name is Adrian Cronauer. Robin Williams played him in that movie, but Adrian is here in real life, not as a movie character, but as a man who works every day for you and me. He works in the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., in the office that essentially looks into missing personnel, MIAs and POWs. Is your office actually in the Pentagon?
No, actually, it's down a couple of metro stops from there in Crystal City.
Crystal City, Virginia.
But as the old saying goes, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
And Adrian, in addition to having a great voice for radio, is here this weekend to help out family members of American servicemen and women who are still missing in action or have stories, I guess, that fall into that same category.
Right. So unaccounted for. Is like
unaccounted for. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. How many unaccounted for servicemen and women do we think we have?
Well, we're pretty close on approximately 88,000. 78,000 of those are from World War II, about 8,100 from the Korean War, about 1,800 from the Vietnam War, and approximately 120 from the Cold War, and then, of course, one each from the First and Second Gulf Wars. Now, when I say 88,000, and of those 78,000 are from World War II, that sounds like an astronomical figure, and it is, really. But a lot of those are people who were on ships that sank or in planes that ditched at sea, and we know we will never recover them. In, for example, the National Cemetery in Hawaii, they sometimes call it the Punch Bowl, there are hundreds if not thousands of remains that we don't know who they are. They are literally unknown soldiers. And we know we will never be able to account for all of those 88,000. But our goal is the fullest possible accounting.
I think what's remarkable about those numbers is how few there are from Vietnam, the war that you served in, which is where I think most people of my generation think that most POW slash MIAs would still be if there were. What was that number again from Vietnam?
It would be about 1,800.
That does not seem like a very large number to me.
It isn't, but then again, it's a relative thing. He's not our boss now, but before he retired, Jerry Jennings, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for POW-MIA Affairs, was over in the Mideast about 2 years ago. And they were talking about the first Gulf War. And there's an organization called the Tripartite Commission, which has been set up to account for missing from that war. And it consists of Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, India, France, and the United States, England, France, and the United States. And they were having a press conference. One of the reporters talked to the Kuwaitis, who said they had about 605 people still missing from that war. Then the Saudis said that they had 30-some that were missing. The reporter turned to my boss and he said, "Mr. Jennings, how many Americans are still missing from that war?" He said, "Just one." "What? You came all the way over here. You are spending all this time and effort and resources and personnel and money and everything else just to account for one single American?" Mr. Jennings looked at him and he said, "Yes." "And what does that tell you about Americans?"
Mm. Had there been more and we had found them and gotten that number down to one, or was there only one the whole time we were fighting that first Gulf War?
Well, as planes crash, they are, or somebody else goes missing, they immediately are classified as unaccounted for, and then as they are accounted for, they're taken off the list. So the numbers during the process of the war itself go up and down and sideways.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have somebody missing for a year.
Usually not. No. Yeah. At least not from the first Gulf War.
And you say there's only one missing from the current conflict.
That's correct. I was going to say specialist. He's now a sergeant, Keith Maupin. All we know at this point is that he's in the hands of the insurgents. And in the first Gulf War, it's a Navy pilot by the name of Scott Spiker who went down the first night of the Gulf War.
Hmm. Have we gotten better at accounting for and recovering our own people? Is that part of it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We are pretty much the pros from Dover on this issue. We're at least 10 years ahead of any other country in our techniques and procedures. And that is because we have been doing it longer than anybody else, and we put far more emphasis on it. Many countries, they just think that we're doing this as that we're a little bit crazy for worrying about old bones. And, for example, the North Koreans, they think we just want to get into their country to spy on them. They really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But we feel that it's important. First of all, we owe it to the people who are still unaccounted for. Secondly, we owe it to their families, their relatives who are still, as some of them described it to me, it's as though there was a hole in their life that was empty and they'd need to fill that in. And thirdly, we owe it to all of the people who are still wearing the uniform, because they need to know, not only in words, but to be demonstrated by deeds, that their government is not going to abandon them.
Was it easier for someone to, I hate to use this phrase, but for lack of a better phrase, I will, get lost in previous wars? Because of the nature of those wars?
I would rather say it's harder today, because we're doing a lot more today than we had been doing in the past. For example, we make sure that the people who, and this is part of our office, we have three functions. One, we want to make sure people don't get become missing to begin with. Secondly, we want to follow up on any reports we hear about possibility of a live American being somewhere. And then thirdly, we want to account for any that we have on the list who are still missing. But today's troops, we want to make sure they are well trained in things like survival and evasion and resistance and escape. We want to make sure they know what to do if they are captured, how to protect themselves. We want to make sure that they have the best electronic equipment. We want to make sure they have good locator beacons and two-way radios. Then the people that go out to look for them, we want to make sure are well-trained in their techniques and how to find them. We want to make sure that, if it's the Air Force and the Marines both looking for the same person, that both the Air Force and the Marines are working from the same playbook.
And not duplicating effort.
That's right. And when we have allies who are working with us, we want to make sure they're in the same playbook as well. So there's a lot of effort that's being done today that wasn't done before. And because of that, we are much less likely to have missing today than we were before. In fact, the only report of a live American that we've ever had since the mid-70s that actually led to a actual live American was in the first Gulf War, and I'm having a senior moment here thinking of her name, but it was a young lady, I believe a private, who was the driver, and we found her through the help of an Iraqi and brought her back.
Mm-hmm. And in many cases, it is the electronics that you talked about, the technology, GPS technology and satellite technology,
sure,
that helps us know where our people are in the first place. And then I'm sure once they go down, in many cases, they've got those electronic beacons you mentioned. But since we're talking about technology and so many are still missing or unaccounted for from wars when we didn't have that technology, and we do go and we find people who have died and we were able to go and figure out where they might have been, do then forensics start becoming a part of what your office does?
Oh, sure. In fact, even before that, when we find that there's a possibility that a particular area might be a gravesite, and each country is different. In Korea, we know pretty much where the battles were, where the POW camps were. In Vietnam, it's harder to find them, but we'll get word that some peasant somewhere remembers seeing a plane crash somewhere. So then we send in professionally trained archaeologists who supervise excavating the crash site to see if we can find the remains. We dig up whatever we can dig up and put it through literally a screen, quarter-inch screen, to sift out anything that might still be there in the area. And then whatever we find is sent back to Hawaii to the identification laboratory, and there we have anthropologists who are able to take just a relatively small amount of bones, and they will look at them and play with them and fool around with them. And finally, they'll say, well, this was a Caucasian male somewhere in his early 20s, He was about 5'9", weighed 135 pounds, and he broke his left arm when he was a kid. Now, that narrows down the number of possibilities right there.
Certainly helps, yeah.
We have an organization called the Armed Forces DNA, or Armed Forces, I'm blanking on the name. There are so many acronyms we use. It's the Life Science Equipment Laboratory down in Texas, in San Antonio. These people are experts on all of the things that are used to support life, things like flight suits and helmets and ejection seats and so forth. You can take them something that looks like a hunk of dirty, muddy, rust-encrusted something and hand it to them. They'll look at it and hold it upside down and turn it around and flip through some pages of some books and look at it some more, and then they'll finally say, this is a buckle from a parachute harness, model number such and such. It was only used in Southeast Asia and only between the years of 1968 and 1971. And they'll go over to a shelf and grab something and say, see, and this is what it looked like new. And son of a gun, that's exactly what it is.
Wow. Any clue like that that can help you get there? This is sort of like a military version of CSI, but looking for our own men and women, not bad guys.
Yes. It's also been compared sometimes to doing a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. Only there's no picture on the box, so you don't know what it's supposed to be. Mm. And furthermore, you don't even know if all those pieces belong to the same puzzle.
So when you go in and you find remains of some kind, you don't know, we're looking for Tony Jenkins, and this is probably him. All you know is, we found some remains, now we have to figure out who it is.
Well, both of those are true.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, if we know approximately from the accounts of a plane crash, for example, if we know approximately when it was and what kind of planes might have crashed in that area and how many were aboard and so forth, that narrows it down to a couple of possibilities.
Then you'll know to look for the pilot or the other crew members, because you know that their remains are probably in that area, and that'll help you point in the right direction.
Right. And something as simple as a piece of leather from the sole of a boot or a button from a sweater can tell you a lot about who it could have possibly been, what service they were in, what kind of climate it was in, and so forth. All of which helped to narrow down again until we get it narrowed down to a very small number.
Remarkable stuff. We'll come back and talk more about it here in just a moment with Adrian Cronauer from the POW MIA office in your Defense Department. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Kind of ironic, I have Adrian Cronauer in the studio. Has a new movie opening.
Yes, isn't it?
Called RV. We're not going to get bogged down in all the Good Morning Vietnam stuff, but I do have to ask you one question that I didn't get to ask you in the two previous times you've been on my show, and that is it true that you wrote the basic concept of Good Morning Vietnam originally as a television sitcom?
Precisely. In 1979, MASH was number one in the ratings. WKRP in Cincinnati was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I figured if you put them together, you have Armed Forces Radio. So I did a treatment for a TV sitcom I called Good Morning Vietnam. At that time, I was in New York doing commercials, and I went around to the different networks to try and peddle it. NBC and CBS wouldn't even look at it. ABC looked at it and said, oh, no, you can't do this. Well, why not? Well, it's war. There's nothing funny about war. Oh, really? You ever hear of McHale's Navy? Ever hear of Hogan's Heroes? You ever hear of MASH? Well, yeah, but that was World War II in Korea. And your point is, well, this is Vietnam. You can't do a comedy about Vietnam. Why not? Well, it's war. There's nothing funny about war. You ever hear about McHale's Navy, Hogan's Heroes, MASH? So a couple of years later, still thinking in terms of television, I redid it as an idea for a movie of the week. This time, a friend's agent got it into Robin's hands. He read it, said, oh, disc jockey, chance to do all my comic shtick. Let's do it, only let's do it as a real movie. He and his manager bought an option on it. Every year, they'd call up and renew the option, and about 4 years later, they called me one day and said, well, we're ready to go into production, but we've decided to throw away the original and start all over again.
Does that mean, by the original, they mean everything you worked on?
Yes.
Okay.
So I went out to Hollywood and spent a week there telling them everything I could remember happening in Vietnam. They'd say things like, oh, that's a great incident. We'll have to use that in the movie. Of course, we'll have to change it totally. It went through about five different versions. In one version, I was captured by the Viet Cong and kept in a bamboo cage. I was glad that never happened. Mm-hmm. And in another version, I married the Vietnamese girl. My wife says she's glad that never happened. And each time I'd make suggestions for additions and deletions and changes. A few of my suggestions they accepted, most of them they ignored. And finally, I'm sitting in a screening room in Hollywood watching a rough cut and saying to myself, son of a gun, they actually made a movie out of this thing.
Even if it's not really the Adrian Cronauer story,
it was never really intended to be an accurate point-by-point biography. It was intended to be a piece of entertainment, and it certainly was that. He was nominated for an Academy Award, and I think he would have got it. But there's an anomaly in the Academy Award thing. There's only one Oscar for Best Actor, and when you have someone in a highly dramatic role running against somebody in a comedic or semi-comedic role, the dramatic one always get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that year it was Michael Douglas for Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Robin got robbed a little bit there.
Yeah, they do ignore comedies or at least overlook them, I think would be the right way to look at it. And you're absolutely right. Anyway, it brought you all the fame and glory and the easy...
Well, name recognition.
The easy name recognition is exactly that. And now you're doing important work with the Defense Department in the POW MIA office. And tomorrow you have an event going on at the Airport Hilton here in St. Louis where you'll be meeting with the families of people who still have unaccounted for servicemen and women in their families.
Right. Every month or so we do this. We'll pick a major metropolitan area and run a hotel ballroom. We invite anybody from about a 350-mile radius who is a relative of someone who is still missing. We invite them to come in. We start 8 o'clock registration, 9 o'clock we start the briefings. We give them PowerPoint briefings. We bring in our people from all over the world to tell them who we are, what we do, how we do it, and so forth. In the afternoon, we give them a printout of whatever information we might have on their own particular missing loved one. We let them talk to an area expert, like if they're missing from Vietnam, we'll let them talk to a Southeast Asia analyst. And, Paul, for some of these people, this is the first time in decades that they have heard anything. Even if we're only able to give them a tiny bit of new information, if it helps them move a little bit closer to closure, it means so much to them and they are so grateful. And it gets a little emotional at times.
I'm sure it does.
And those of us who work on this, and there are a lot of us, there's only about 20 or 30 of our people at these meetings, but we have over 100 people in Washington. There are over 500 people elsewhere throughout the world who work on nothing else all day long but trying to account for America's missing. And invariably, after we finish the day, the reaction I get from people is, my Lord, I had no idea that this was all going on, that the government was doing all of this. But we feel it's important that we do this because we've made a promise.
Do you ever have people come in and ask you about somebody and you don't know anything about them?
There are those cases, yes. And if we don't know anything, we say so. But
does that help you then to open a file and start looking for them? Or
sometimes, yes. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, do you know anything about John Jones, and there's nothing there to open a file, we will add their name to our list as a relative. And that's one of the reasons I appreciate the chance to talk to your listeners today, because we notify anybody we know who lives in this area in St. Louis to come to join us. But our lists are not totally comprehensive. And maybe somebody listening to KMOX right now is a relative of somebody who's still missing, and you haven't heard about this because you are not on our list. You are more than welcome. We would love to see you come by tomorrow at the Airport Hilton. As I said, registration is between 8 and 9. Come by, and then we can add you to our list and keep you up to date on what we're doing as well.
Do you have to get information from them that helps you in your search?
Many times we do, yes. Mm-hmm. And one of the main things is DNA that we get. Because a decade ago, hardly anything was being done with DNA. by now, maybe about 80 or more percent of the cases involve DNA analysis. Most of the time, DNA is the final step to confirm what we've already determined by other things, external information. And we've whittled it down so that we can go to the DNA people and say, okay, we think this is Sam Jones. And they can say either yes, it is, or it isn't. Or we can say, we think this is either Smith or Jones or Wojciechowski. At that point, they can say, it's none of them. It could be Smith and Jones, but it's not Wojciechowski. Or it could be all three of them. Or we just don't have enough information.
So would it help if somebody were coming tomorrow to talk to you to bring something that might have the DNA of their loved one?
If you can do that, that would be great. But if you can't, what we would do is take a cheek swab. We'll take a gadget that looks like a cross between a Q-tip and a toothbrush, and we just run it across the inside of your cheek. And that gives us enough material that we're able to get a good, usable DNA sample. And those are all kept on file. For the past decade, anybody who has been on active duty in the military has had to give a blood sample. Just a little pinprick on their finger goes on, two drops of it go on to a piece of blotting paper about the size of a postcard. And those two drops expand each of them to about the size of a quarter. We put the information, identification information on there. It's vacuum sealed in foil and kept in a gigantic three-story refrigerator at minus 20 degrees. And we are approaching 5 million samples now.
Wow.
But that only goes back to the people who've been on active duty in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So if you have a relative who is missing from Vietnam or Korea or even the Second World War, then we have to rely on actual relatives. And it goes down the matrilineal line. There are two kinds of DNA, nuclear and mitochondrial. Nuclear DNA doesn't last very long. It's very unstable and it deteriorates very quickly. But mitochondrial DNA lasts long. We've gotten mitochondrial usable DNA from a mummy that's been over 3,000 years old. So if you can find, for example, your DNA is the same as your brothers and sisters,
mm-hmm.
and that's because it's the same as your mother's, and it's also the same as her mother's. And her siblings, your children, have the same DNA.
Mm-hmm. So if you can find a blood relative...
Wait, I'm sorry, no. Your wife's children
mm-hmm.
have that same DNA, but not yours.
Mm-hmm.
Your sister's children will have it.
So if you can find an ancestor along the maternal line,
right.
That helps you even more. Mm-hmm. All right, let me take another break, and we'll come back and talk more about this and give you more details again on what Adrian's going to be doing tomorrow at the Airport Hilton here in St. Louis from the Defense POW and Missing Personnel Office. It's Adrian Cronauer on the Paul Harris Show. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Adrian Cronauer from the Defense POW Missing Personnel Office, more commonly known as the PWMIA Office. At the Department of Defense.
Adrian Cronauer. Now, why do I know that name?
Adrian, of course, was the character played by Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam, or a fictionalized version of him anyway. This is the real deal.
Loosely, yeah.
You're not the fictional. You're the non-fiction.
I'm the real guy.
You're the real guy. And in town to do some important work with families who have unaccounted for servicemen and women. Tomorrow at the Airport Hilton, starting at 8 a.m., they'll be registering people, and from 9 o'clock on, they'll be meeting them. And during the commercial break, you said we have to talk about oral histories. What is that?
We go out, some of our analysts go out to when veterans have reunions and talk to them about where they were and what they saw and did they see anybody who was killed, what happened to their bodies. And we do this not only with American veterans. We do with the same thing with veterans in the other countries where we're looking for, in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. And we have six people on permanent duty at our embassy in Moscow going through documents that are released ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, declassified, and talking to some of their veterans as well. All of it looking for little clues that when you put them all together, help us find missing Americans.
How are we doing taking care of our veterans in this country?
The veterans' hospitals, when people came back from Vietnam, were not the best in the world. They were a little short of funds, shall we say. But right now, some of the best medical care you can possibly get is in a veterans hospital.
But I hear from some veterans every once in a while that it still takes them quite a while to get to see a doctor or to get the care that they need. That once they get in there and can actually get to that room where there is medical professionals, where there are medical professionals ready to work on them, that's a good thing, but that sometimes they run into a backlog. Is there an undersupply of that for veterans?
No, I think in those kinds of cases, I think probably what's happening is it's just, it's like traffic on the highway. Every once in a while you hit a slowdown or a knot of traffic. But I have been to some of the medical facilities and to get shots and things for some of my travels,
mm-hmm.
and I have never had any problems.
Well, let's get back to the missing personnel. When we have found people still alive and mm-hmm. been able to re-assimilate them, I guess that's the appropriate word for it, especially for somebody who might have been missing for a while.
Sure.
Is the government there to help them with that process?
Yes. Our office doesn't do that, actually. But the service casualty offices take care of this. And each service takes care of their own people. And there are very, very extensive programs to help them first of all, to just decompress. One of the problems we have, for example, is that when somebody is rescued and brought back into American hands, and their relatives all want to, or their at least their wife or their mother and father want to come see them immediately, which is sometimes the worst thing that can happen.
Why?
Because psychologically they need that time to decompress and reorient themselves to where they are. Then is the time when they need the close relatives to be there to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, talk to them on the phone, but don't get too close too quickly.
Do we have stories of people who've been missing for what would most people would consider to be a tremendously long time and then had difficulty reassimilating? You know, everybody's heard that story of, oh, there was that guy on that island, and he was there for 20 years. Are any of those true?
As far as I know, no. We have not had any like that at all. I know that they just recently discovered somewhere on some remote island, so a Japanese soldier from World War II who didn't know the war was over. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, we don't have any of those cases in America.
Isn't that funny that he didn't really know the war? You'd think at some point, it's got to be Tuesday. This can't possibly still be going on. Now working for you and me and the American taxpayers and really the families of American servicemen and women in the Office of the Defense POW and Missing Personnel, part of the Secretary of Defense's office. How's Rumsfeld doing, by the way?
Last time I saw him, he was smiling. So.
had a couple of rough weeks here.
Oh, yeah.
But
Harry Truman said it very well. He said, in Washington, if you want a friend, buy yourself a dog.
I don't want to get into all the politics of that. So I want to talk more about the mission that you and the people in your office
right.
do with families like the ones you're going to meet with tomorrow who still want information about missing loved ones. Is there a certain point that you find with them that they do move on?
Some do, and some never will. It depends upon the individual. It depends upon the circumstances of the particular case. Some people, no matter how much evidence there is, will never accept the idea that their loved one is really, truly missing. And that happens. But for some people, that hole in their life, as they describe, gets smaller and smaller. But it's still a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And
even if they've moved on and mm-hmm. in some cases,
until the remains have been brought back. Now, the person who was the missing person from the Vietnam War for 9 years, after that time in 1991, we got some circumstantial evidence enough that we thought we knew who it was. We exhumed the remains, did a DNA test, and son of a gun, he is buried right outside of St. Louis. His name was Michael Blassie. He was mm-hmm. an Air Force pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always working on it. We're always trying our best. But most of the time, if we haven't found out yet, it's because all of the leads that we've turned out ran out and didn't lead anywhere.
If you're within the sound of the giant KMOX signal and you can get to the Airport Hilton tomorrow, you can meet with Adrian and his staff from the POW-MIA office. They'll start registrations at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I thank you very much for your time here today.
I should mention, Paul, that it's only for family members.
Only family members.
But if you are a family member, we certainly want to see you, and we will welcome you with open arms.
After having talked to you on the air a couple of times, it's nice to see you face-to-face.
Always good to see you, Paul.
Thank you very much
for having me on the air.
Adrian Cronauer here on the Paul Harris Show. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX.